This is Beverly Osband, November 5th, 1994. Fate, Unfairness, and Jung's Answer to Job, Workshop, Tape 1 of 2.
Does it go just to the middle, to the straight line, or all the way? Is that okay now? Okay, good. Just so we can be a little cozier, since we're a nice small group this morning. And thanks for the introduction, Lucretia. What I'd like to do today, because I think almost everybody was here last night. Were you here? You weren't here. But you're going to listen, okay? And you weren't here either, Cass. So we can do some reviewing about what I talked about last night with respect to Job and answer to Job. Although since most people were here, I don't want to go through the whole thing. But it's going to be a good chance for discussion today. I can't talk for 3 hours. I can't talk for an hour and a half, probably. So I want to keep it a little bit informal. And at the same time, last night what I didn't get to and what I would like to spend more time on today is a little bit more on fate and on this notion of unfairness, which I think is something that we all grapple with from time to time in our lives, sometimes quite a lot. But I thought what I'd like to do is start out with a little story. And the story is called The Road to Samarra, and it's a Sufi story, and it goes like this. One day, there was a young man who worked in the home of a very wealthy merchant, and the merchant came to him and said, I'm having guests this weekend. Here's money. Go to the market and buy meat and fruit and wine and all kinds of good things for my party. And so with a pocket full of money, the young man left for the market riding on his horse. And he got to the market and began to go from stall to stall, and there were beautiful things to buy. And at one point he glanced up, and across the market he saw death standing, beckoning to him. And he became terrified. And without buying anything, he leaped onto his horse and began to ride away. And he rode and he rode and he rode, and finally, at midnight, exhausted and dirty, he came to the town of Samarra. And there was a little inn there, and so with the money that he had gotten from his master to buy all of the food for the weekend guests, he paid for a room at the inn. And he went to bed. He just fell on the bed, exhausted. He slept for a while, and then there was a knock at the door. And at first he thought he was dreaming, and then the knock came again. And he stumbled and got out of bed and went to the door, and he opened the door. And there stood death. He said, But I thought you were in Isfahan this morning and that I'd gotten away from you. And death said, I was. I was merely there to tell you to meet me here in Samarra tonight. And so I think what the story tells us is that in spite of what we may think about fate, we really do have an awful lot of free will. That there's a way in which part of the paradox of fate is that its culmination or its fruition requires us in order to be realized. That's what this young man found out on his journey. One of the things I mentioned last night is that in our modern culture, that fate is kind of a four-letter word. It's not a very popular notion. We tend to think of it very negatively. And I think a lot of this is due to our sort of this ethos, and especially perhaps in democratic countries or in countries in the free world, we grow up with this notion of self-determination, that we can do anything we want to do. And that somehow when we don't do that, we feel like we failed. That when we don't take advantage of that, we failed. And I think the other side of it is that if we give up that notion that we're in charge of our lives, that our sense of frailty and powerlessness and vulnerability has the capacity to overwhelm us. It's scary to think that we're not in charge. It's terrifying. And I think often we realize that when something bad happens. When there's an accident, when there's an untimely death, when the company we work for goes under and people all lose their jobs, And then we begin to ask questions, you know, who's in charge here? I thought I had control over things. We really don't. And Jung writes this dilemma that we face often when we're confronted with this sense of powerlessness. We can really almost feel paralyzed. And he writes that about this kind of dilemma, feeling like we're responsible but powerless, that we're supposed to act, but things are determined for us. He writes that all passion is a challenge to fate, and what it does cannot be undone. Fear of fate is a very understandable phenomenon, for it's incalculable, immeasurable, and full of unknown dangers. And I think particularly in our culture, more so than in some Eastern cultures, there's this real, it's very hard to give over to what is happening, what's being given to us. And I'm kind of wondering, you know, as I'm talking about this, what your sense of it is, what thoughts you might have about that. Mm-hmm. Oh, what were you talking about? Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. So that it's kind of. Yeah, and that's a pretty good summary of the distinction that I was making. And when I was talking about fate last night, it was in the sense that the Greeks thought about fate as a kind of moral order or natural order of things. That it was a force in the cosmos that didn't have to do so much with individual human beings as it did with the broader scope of events. And the broader scope within which humans acted, lived, and that destiny had much more to do with the individual, and that one's destiny was as much a reflection of inner processes as it was outer events. The sense of the inner daimon that would kind of determine and push and pull and sort of magnetically bring us toward whatever it is we're to be doing at any given time. So does that kind of That's interesting. And what you're referring to is that in general, not always, but often, the fates were in threes. There were three goddesses of fate. There were the three Erinyes, the three, and it's there's a lot of similarities. One of the things that when I first started looking at this whole issue of fate in Greek literature, I expected there to be something fairly straightforward, you know. These are the fates. This is when they originated, and this is what they did, and so on and so forth. And I was just trying to find in my notes here some of that information. But this notion, I think that it's sort of what you're doing is weaving together the sort of Jungian emphasis on the numbers. The three is a kind of unstable, dynamic, active constellation that wants to become something else. And maybe we could think about the fates being the three and adding destiny as the fourth brings the individual towards the realization of what he or she is all about in the world. One of the things that I thought was real interesting, and I found this wonderful book by a man named William Green. It was from 1944. And it's just dense. I mean, this is incredibly dense, and it's called Moira. Was it Moira, Fate, Good, and Evil in Greek Thought? And he really historically traces from the very earliest recorded Greek literature the evolution of the Greek response to fate from the very earliest times to later times. And one of the first Greek writers who wrote about the fates was Hesiod. And he actually started out with his earliest theogony. Hesiod said that the Moirai were the daughters of night, that along with Moros, Keres, and Nemesis, all these sort of negative, black, dark creatures or forces that, I think it's better to call them forces than creatures, that influenced the birth and death and the length of life and illness and pestilence and all of those things. So in his earliest theogony, Hesiod called these three the birth goddesses, Clotho and Lachesis and Atropos. And he said of them that they give men at birth both good and evil to have. So there was this sense that whatever happened, whether it was good or whether it was bad, came out of these three. But then as this evolved, he came up with yet another pedigree for the fates. And I got so confused about this, because in one place I'd be reading, well, they're the daughters of night. And in another place I would be reading, no, they're the daughters of Zeus and Themis. And so that in this later sort of pedigree, he had them defined as the daughters of Zeus and Themis, and said that their powers, despite the fact that they were the daughters of these two, well, Zeus was a god and Themis was a little bit of an under goddess. She was the goddess of justice, who also gave birth to the other goddesses that were related to justice. And we'll talk about those maybe a little bit later on. But he said of them that their powers exceeded Zeus's power. And there's this wonderful section in the Prometheus trilogy where Prometheus is talking and really conversing with the chorus, puzzling out his own fate. Because here he's being, you know, he's being tied to the rock, having his liver plucked out because of his transgressions. And this was one of those situations in which Zeus took revenge on an individual. Usually Zeus was much more concerned, wasn't really all that concerned with individuals like Yahweh was. But this was one of those situations where he was so angry with Prometheus that he really damned him. And so as Prometheus finds himself in this terrible place, in Aeschylus's trilogy, he says, not in this way hath all ordained Moira decreed that these things shall be fulfilled. Yet after being racked by countless woes and sufferings, I am to escape these bonds. But craft, which is techne, is far weaker than necessity, which is ananke. And he asks, this is what the chorus said, and then Prometheus asks, who holds the helm of necessity? And the chorus answers, the triform Moirai and the ever-mindful Erinyes. And Prometheus asks, and Zeus, is he weaker than those? And the chorus answers, he may not avoid what is destined. And Prometheus asks, what is destined for Zeus but endless rule? And the chorus answers, ask not, neither set thy heart on knowing. It's better not to know what Zeus is going to come to. Because this is probably at that point when, and I mentioned this last night in talking about An Answer to Job, where Jung explores the notion that the Greeks were more capable of relativizing their gods, of seeing their gods as not all-powerful, as having combined in them good and evil, than were the Hebrews, who had to see their God as all good, who couldn't bear the thought that this God might also contain evil. And so there's this sense that the Greeks, fairly early on, were able to look at what was happening there in their lives, the earthquakes, the famine, the terrible things that they were living with, and ask, you know, is this really our fault? Or are the gods sometimes fallible? Are the gods sometimes just bad? Do they take their revenge on us when we've done nothing to deserve their maltreatment?
Mm-hmm.
Or to the not doing. I mean, in Job, there's this question: did he do anything to deserve what happened to him? Sure. Right. Some, yeah. Sure. Yeah, and there is this sense of and I'm not sure how she would deal with this, but there is this sense of really wanting to explore all of the facets of Yahweh and not simply see it as him or it as a unidimensional force in the world, and this is I think a lot of what Jung struggles with in Answer to Job is what are the dimensions of this energy, this Yahweh energy. Is it ethical? Is it moral? Does it have a quality of good about it, or is it unpredictable? Does it really contain it, as Jung says, and I agree, as Job found out, does it contain both good and evil? And do we simply have to accept that that's the way it is? That we can't make assumptions that if we pray properly, if we do everything by the book, that we'll be rewarded. Are you saying that at some level we need to let go of that notion of perfection and be what we are then? Okay. Yeah. That's right. I think that's why so many people have difficulty with the epilogue to Job, where in the epilogue Job is given back all that he had lost, all of his wealth, and he's given back children. And I mentioned last night, for those of you who weren't here, that the children he was given back were not his original children, but he was given back these wonderful young people. Well, that's all well and good, but what parent wants anything but his own children? And in a way, it's an insult to be given back those children now to raise and to worry over, because the ones that he had raised from infancy, from birth, were gone, never to come back. We could say. Could you say some more about that? It keeps us out of that sort of groveling subservience and fear of acting. It can keep us in balance. Sure. Instead of that sort of kind of paradoxical inflation that I know the way to maintain myself in this good place, if I just do these things, because this is what my relationship with the powers is. But that sort of more humble place of not knowing.
Yeah. It also keeps us learning in the balance of
Sure.
And my brain and my head have become so big and blessed. And I really can't function very well. It's not really even from my head.
Sure. And that's really what inflation is. It's that sense of, I know all the answers. They're right here in this head that gets bigger and bigger and bigger. And it is a real imbalance. And you can almost imagine a physical imbalance of falling on your head or falling on your face when it gets that large. So full of those certainties. And I've even wondered in dealing with people I've known who really subscribe to that kind of thinking, that sort of constant nervousness about their responsibility to continue to do it just the right way. If I stir the pot, quite literally, there are rules about the direction of stirring the pot. And if I stir the pot the wrong way, will the heavens open? You know, that's an awful lot of power for an individual to take on themselves. And it is literally sickening. It can become sickening to the individual. Pardon? Sure. A sort of fanaticism. Sure. Mm-hmm. Well, that Jung points out in the early part of Answer to Job this, and he really begins it in I believe it was in the prologue, this discussion about, you know, if modern man is to really regard himself as believing in a monotheistic deity, then it becomes necessary to combine the good and evil in one. But that the early Christian church, after the first couple of centuries BC, AD, had such a hard time with this that it was they who really promulgated this split where Satan was down and the Lord was up, and the Lord ruled with the good and Satan with the bad. But that the very early church really combined both, and God ruled with his right hand and his left hand. I'm left-handed, so I always with his right hand and his left hand. I realized that last night when I was gesturing that I had said the right hand, and for me this is my right hand. That's true. I guess that's okay. Right. I pronounce it Ellie, but Ellie Wiesel. Yeah. I'm wondering what other folks think about that. What your responses are to that notion of the sort of metaphorical, never having lost and always having, which is really almost that sense of the almost unattainable.
Well, you have everything.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's one of the difficulties, that we really are caught in the cultures in which we live, this predominant culture. I mean, for some people it is materialism. And when their house burns down, the devastation is overwhelming because there are so many things that are lost. When someone close to them dies, it's unimaginably painful to live without that person here, physically here now. And that's where we are. And it's this tradition that has such a difficult time with this notion of fate, or with some of the Buddhist or other Eastern philosophies. And yet there is a big push, and I think we see this all around us. You go to the bookstore and the shelves are filled with books that are trying to bring that tradition, the Buddhist tradition, or the more the less materialistic, less causal thinking type of tradition into Western culture. You know, the epilogue doesn't tell us that, because the epilogue is really just told in the narrator's words, at least in the translations that I've read. It's really just told in the narrator's words of saying, it's almost, you know, like you could imagine in a film, the credits are running and you're told this is how the story ends. And so you don't really know, and that's why this essay, I found this essay by Elie Wiesel so fascinating, because he really explored the various ways in which Job might have been responding. You know, it's possible that Job responded by being happy, by saying, isn't this wonderful? Wiesel doesn't like that. He doesn't like the thought that Job just gave in and meekly and happily said, phew, boy, that was rough, and now I'm glad I've got it easy again. He doesn't like that one at all. His preference is that the epilogue, that the real end of the story was lost, and this epilogue was kind of tacked on very secondarily, and that Job either was consumed with his grief and died, despite being given back all of this wealth, or that alternatively, and this is what Jung was, I think, getting at too, that Job had this light had gone on for Job, and he now knew, this is not a God I can depend on to take care of me. This is a God who will sometimes do unpredictable and very, very horrible things. And I know that now. And I'm almost filled with relief knowing that now. But I will placate that God, and I will say, I know you're powerful. I know I can't do what you can do. I will repent in dust. And in a sense say, I will keep my own counsel. There was now a sort of inner knowing that he hadn't had before, that he could then go on with his life, and I think Wiesel says it, and I've got the quote here. Whoops, I don't want to make a lot of noise on the recorder. Where Wiesel says that something to the effect that Job did not choose resignation, that he was a man who, I can't find it, I don't want to spend time right now, but that he was, he really used his giving in as a kind of decoy, and that he now could live his life out, knowing what he knew, a sobered and more knowing man, not seduced by these gifts that were being given back to him. Right, and I think that's true. But I think what Jung then becomes concerned with in answer to Job is not just the effect that this experience had on Job, but the effect that it had on Yahweh, and that not only was Job's consciousness raised by his experience, but Yahweh's was also. Right. Yeah. Okay. And that the evolution, and we talked about this. I think you mentioned this last night. We talked about it a little bit last night, that then the way Yahweh evolved and moved on toward the incarnation with the birth of Christ, I think Jung would argue that it wouldn't have happened had it not been for his experience of Job. That Yahweh, through his experience of Job's suffering, came to an understanding of suffering that he didn't have before. Even though there were many ways in which he had done terrible things to people before, we know that in the flood he destroyed everything except Noah and the pairs of all the species that Noah had taken into the ark, and of course there's the experience of Adam and Eve being thrown out of the Garden of Eden. That was a setup. He said, "Now don't eat from that tree." You know, he could have just left the tree standing there and not said anything to them. This was paradise. They could have eaten from anything. But there's a way in which he couldn't just let it be. He was a very unevolved, very unconscious being at that time. And his evolution from Adam, from the time of Genesis on through the Old Testament and then into the New Testament is really what answer to Job is one of the messages in the answer to Job, a kind of exploration of that evolvement. The girls have names. Just the girls, not the boys. Uh-huh. That's right. They're just children.
So it does get some sense to me. Yes, very powerful.
It is. It's extraordinary. And I would agree with you, except for one thing, that the way he begins this long discussion is in the sense of a challenge to Job. In a sense saying to Job, and it may be what you're saying too in a way, but a slightly different flavor to it. Essentially, I think he's saying to Job, you know, you're questioning me, and yet look at what I have to do every day. Do you have to do any of these things? You know, I can't be bothered with you, you little worm, you little man who feels so mistreated. So there is that sense of, but there's this mismatch. I mean, why bother with him at all? Why not just leave him in sitting in the dust, scratching his boil? There is this way in which God comes and says, you know, you want something from me, and I have all this to do, and you know, tell me about it. What do you know about it? I'm going to tell you about it. When he says, please instruct me, to Job, there's in there a challenge between completely unequal powers. So there's this sort of, I think this is a place where Jung gets very angry. And this anger of his, that I think that whoever was sitting in the back and asked the question, isn't Jung stuck in his anger against this mismatched argument that's going on here? And the other piece of it, though, in the voice from the whirlwind, is that never in that whole piece does Yahweh answer Job's question, what did I do wrong? What did I do to deserve it? There's no real addressing of Job as a person in pain and suffering. I don't think there's a way that we can do it. And it does kind of... What's your response? Well, make it fit. You know, we do have all this knowledge. I mean, you know, given, for example, we have a tremendous amount of knowledge about cancer. We have all kinds of protocols for treating it. We really have no way to know for certain that we can cure it. And yet we pursue it as if we know what we're doing. There are some people who would say that those kinds of treatments are immoral because they cause so much pain. Sometimes they cause death. We proceed as if we know what we're about, but we really don't. I think is something that comes upon us in our individual experiences, when we find ourselves expressing it and we're caught in that moment of saying, wait a moment, who's listening? And it does come, but I do think it comes at that moment of expression, of realizing that once and for all, being able to ask the question, wait a minute, who's listening? Is it a being that's listening who cares and who will act? Is it an indifferent thing? Is it a being at all? But it's not until we get it out that can happen. One thing, though, and just in response to what you were saying, Eberhard, about the individual, and I think there's a risk that we do think of Job as just as the individual and think of him maybe a bit too concretely, because I do think he's a metaphor not just for the individual who loses, but for the community that loses, and that's the community that's that's made to suffer. And I think, you know, in our world today, you can't pick up the paper on any day without thinking about or without being confronted with the horrors of Bosnia and Serbia and Rwanda. And each of these, I can remember last summer seeing a photograph in the paper. It was at the foot of the falls in Lake Victoria. All of these bodies just tangled up, Rwandan people who had been murdered and thrown into the river. And what struck me was that each of these was an individual, and together they were the community that was being destroyed. And I found myself asking, like Job was asking, you know, what is going on here? What did each of these people, these tiny babies, these women, these young men, these teenagers, these kids, what have they done? What is this world, this evil about? And so I think we really do need to think of Job both concretely but also metaphorically, and what he represents in the sense of dealing with powers that confront us, that affect us, that change our lives, and against which we have no power but maybe to rage. And it's that sometimes that rage, that capacity to continue to question, that I think keeps us alive. And I think Viktor Frankl, in his reflections on his experiences in the camps, that it was the people who just gave in, who lost their capacity for feeling as if there was something to work against. That those people who just gave in, who acquiesced, were the ones who quickly succumbed to typhus or cholera or whatever and died. I think what I'd probably like to do just around time is maybe talk another 10 minutes or so and then take a break. And there are lots of good things out there on the table that folks have put together, and then come back at 11:30 and talk a little longer. I think it's real. It's so fascinating. It was so fascinating to me as I was studying this and preparing this presentation, to go all the way back to the ancient Greeks, because in so many ways our cultures have been built on their foundation blocks. And the very earliest Greeks were surprisingly similar in many ways, I think, to all of us, that they had a sort of pessimistic view of life. And they felt this tremendous power that they couldn't quite understand. They felt that that there was this sense of only getting good through suffering, that they could only assure their well-being through suffering, and that it was only... That as they evolved, that sort of codes of humanism developed, where through intelligence and through development of skill, they could live a reasonably good life. But there was always this sense of vulnerability, of having to live in the grip of a power that they couldn't really completely comprehend. I just thought that was really interesting. And then one more that I'd like to share with you before we take the break. Was that, and I mentioned this last night, that generally the fates have been feminine forces, and it's kind of interesting where you bring up the masculine, because in my going through the library, and it's wonderful in this computer age, you know, you plug in fate, or you plug in, you know, a single word or two, and you get this printout. and I was really fascinated that most of the printout that I got, the journal articles, had more to do with a sense of fatalism. Research that was done, kind of demographic and psychological research that was done on people who had lived through disasters and their sense of vulnerability around those disasters. And it was that sense of, that I think gives fate such a negative connotation in our culture, that I am doomed, I am fated to another disaster or another accident or another terrible thing happening. But one of the things that turned up on this computer search was a wonderful little book it's about this thick, and it was entitled Oedipus and Job in West African Religion. And so I had to head for the stacks right away. And basically what it was a kind of festschrift for this very famous anthropologist who was very well known for his, he worked in the early part of the century, and he would go into these far off places and he would do these studies and come up with these sort of grandiose schemes of what was really going on in that culture. And as time went on, he earned a little bit of a bad reputation because he always knew more than the natives did about their culture and so forth. But still, his adventuresome spirit and his desire to learn about these obscure cultures was the foundation on which a lot of, you know, of the 1940s and 50s anthropologists built their careers. At any rate, this one, this book by Meyer Fortas, talks about fate in these West African tribes, and what he noticed there was that fate was not linked to the feminine, but it was linked to ancestor worship. And so I'll just read to you what some of my notes that came out of this little book. In these tribes in West Africa, one's fate is manifested in economic success and more generally in the ability of a man to take his place in the social structure of the tribe. In describing the acquisition of one's fate in the Yoruba culture, Fortas notes that before birth, the child's soul is said to kneel before the deity, which is Oldumare, and to choose Yan, its fate, on earth. Those who humbly kneel and make their reasonable requests to God, which in these requests would be for food, for money, and for children, they would receive these things during their lives. However, those who make requests as if they had a right to expect whatever was wanted, they do not receive what they've asked for. Now, according to Fortas, in the Tolensi culture, the acceptance of one's destiny is very important. He says, destiny is ideally beneficent, provided only that the ward, the recipient, accepts his destiny ancestors and serves and obeys them. And this reminded me of a statement I had read of Jung, which is, free will is the ability to do gladly that which we must do. And for the Tolensi, there is good prenatal destiny and evil prenatal destiny. Now, evil prenatal destiny is diagnosed in those whose apparent hard work and efforts are just, even through all of this, they're just not able to fulfill their role in the social structure as a worker, a husband, and a father. The Tolensi do not believe that evil prenatal destiny can be thwarted by acts of will, but only by ritual measures, which seek to propitiate the forces that are at work. And so for a Tolensi tribesman, if his children die, if his crops don't grow, if the hunt doesn't go well, then his sense is that he's done something to offend his ancestors, and that he was given an evil prenatal destiny. And so he goes and prays to his ancestors and asks, you know, what can I do? And ritually is put through various processes, ritual kinds of celebrations and gifts and sacrifices in order to change his evil prenatal destiny. His willfulness about it, his determination about it, won't get him anywhere, which I thought was really interesting. What I also found really interesting as I was reading through this, I was thinking to myself, well, what about the women? You know, don't the women have some fate? Where do they get their good prenatal destiny or evil prenatal destiny? And it turns out that it all comes through the father and through the husband. So that a woman's father, if a woman's father has good prenatal destiny, so will she. And then if she marries and her husband has evil prenatal destiny, her destiny will change. And she has to go along with her husband and celebrating the rituals and accepting his what comes to him. So I thought that was a real interesting variation on these themes that come from the Greek culture, which revolve around the feminine, and, the earth goddess as the source of fate and destiny. And so much of what our cultures have built on comes from much more from that than from the more southern, the African or Indian, right, is the feminine in these other cultures. in the West, and in other cultures, it's not necessarily the feminine. Right. And do all of those things. Well, why don't we take a break for about 15 or 20 minutes and then come back and have a little more time to talk about unfairness. Start again. One of the things I wanted to talk about or to get back to, I mentioned it last night and it came up a little bit in the questions and answers afterwards, was this notion of necessity. And I've got some notes that I'd like to share with you and then talk about that. And then I also don't want to leave out the section on unfairness, because that's something we didn't get to at all last night, and it would be unfair not to to give it a little bit of attention. Right, right. So this whole notion of necessity, there's in some of the writings, necessity is considered the mother of fate, and in other writings, necessity is considered an entity unto itself. And there's a really interesting book by a man named Bernard Williams, and called Shame and Necessity, in which he looks at this notion of why it is, I suppose you could say, why it is in life that certain things must be done, that we seem not to have a choice around doing them. I mean, technically, I suppose you could say we do have a choice. But there's a way in which we couldn't live with ourselves if we didn't do whatever we were being asked to do. And so if any of you are interested in that book, I know it's one that's at the bookstore. It's probably in the libraries, too. Shame and Necessity. And it's a real recent one. It came out, I think it was in 93. William Green. I'm sorry, no. Bernard Williams. There's so many Williams and Greens in this thing. It's Bernard Williams. So he explores aspects and types of necessity, one of which has to do with things happening as they must happen, things being done as they must be done, not in the sense of some kind of moral imperative, but because there's an inner desire to follow through and to do it. He goes on to talk about the complexity of necessity, and he notes that, on the one hand, the source of necessity is in the agent or in the individual, and this is an internalized other. It feels like an internalized other that the agent can respect. And some of the examples that he gives, I'll mention those a little later on, but you might kind of keep them in mind, is Oedipus is one, and Antigone in the ancient Greek tragedies was another person who fell into this kind of position of must, of having to act, of having to do what needed to be done. He says this is a necessity to act in such a way that one can continue to look others in the eye, to act so as to avoid shame. This kind of necessity has the feeling of the daimon about it, this kind of inner force that moves us toward a certain end. It's not the same kind of thing that divine necessity is in the sort of Judeo-Christian sense of redemption because we do, but it's more of an ability to live with ourselves that this kind of necessity is about. So there's a sense of purpose about this kind of necessity, sometimes the feeling that there is a supernatural power involved. You could say that it was fate or some other kind of force pushing us. But there is this sense that if we don't do it, if we fail to act and to move, that it's not just a matter of guilt. I think we tend to reduce those things to guilt, but it's really a sense of, I can't live with myself anymore. It would be that wrong. And I think Antigone in the Greek tragedies is an excellent example of that. Her brother died in battle, and her uncle said that she couldn't bury him, and she knew that she must bury him, and she knew that it could mean the end of her life if she did, even though what she was doing was right. She couldn't live with herself if she didn't bury him, and so she did that, and ultimately she did die. Of course, the person who was responsible for her death ultimately fell also, Creon, her uncle. But that was a couple of steps removed. For her, in her life, she needed to do that. And just as Oedipus felt that he needed to leave his home, it was necessary to do that to avoid his fate, what the oracle had given him. But more than that, at the end of his life, when he realized all of what he had done, there are some people who say that the real tragedy in Oedipus was not that he murdered his father and married his mother, but that having done so and having realized what these terrible things that he had done, that he then blinded himself and exiled himself. That was the real tragedy in his life. And just in concluding this discussion on fate, I think it's real important to think about fate in the sense of that Christianity has dealt with it, in part because it's been pretty much expunged from the Christian vocabulary. And I mentioned this last night, it was seen as a kind of challenge to the sovereignty of the deity, the fates were. And so this term was replaced really with the concept of divine providence when things went well. But the fates were not the only feminine forces that were removed from the church at the same time. The cult of Mary was also removed from the church at that time, and it was only reinstated centuries later when it was decided that Mary wasn't such a threatening figure after all, and the church could stand to have at least one feminine element included. Token. the token female. So before I start dealing with this issue of unfairness and injustice, are there thoughts that you have about this notion of necessity? That's interesting. In fact, I think that just that last point. And did you want to say something, Lucretia? Or that's you're saying it very well. That's right. And that's one of the ways that Jung talks about it too. That we, as we sit here at this moment, have a very narrow perception of the broader scheme that's come before and will come after us, that we're kind of caught in this little moment in this not grand in the sense of grandiose, but in the enormity of the cosmos. And for any one event affecting us to for it to be anything other than this grain of sand, or for us to understand its ramifications, we can't see that far. There's this, and I keep trying to find it. Someone gave me the reference, and I looked it up, and it was in the wrong place. It wasn't the story that I was looking for. But there is a story I think that comes out of the Buddhist tradition, that the Buddha was taking a student with him on the road, and the Buddha had been preaching that you mustn't kill. And each, there were three encounters, and in each case, the student was not supposed to ask a question. And each time the Buddha did something that seemed to be against the law, one was killing, one was stealing, one was something else. And in each case, the teacher answered, "What you don't know is that this person would be a murderer, and I'm protecting the people he would murder. What you don't know is that if I left this here, it would poison these people." Or that sort of thing, that we only can see just so far. And even though we try to see into the future, we try to think in long-ranging terms, we are extraordinarily limited in our capacity to imagine. I quite agree with you, and I've certainly struggled with why it was necessary for certain things to happen. Years ago when I was first working as a nurse, this was about 12 or 13 years ago, and I was working on a unit for babies, newborn babies, all of them desperately sick, born with heart defects and brain defects and everything under the sun. And I would look at them and think, what possible purpose does this serve? Why did these little ones have to come into the world this way? I couldn't understand it. I still don't know that I understand it. But what I do know is that it may be important that I don't understand it. Somewhere along the line, it may have some meaning that I can say, now I understand. maybe not in my own lifetime. And so it's, I think it's very hard. And I agree with you. I had a very similar response when that ferry went down off the coast of Finland with 1,000 people on board. And it was due to human negligence. And I thought, why should these people pay for the negligence of others? But that's causal thinking. That's what I was raised with. That's the culture I live in. To get out of it requires a leap that I struggle with. Lucretia? It is. It really requires that capacity, often hard won through tremendous pain, of going beyond the will, going beyond what the ego wants, needs, has depended on, and an acceptance that sometimes just comes in a flash, and it does. It can come just in a flash, and it can disappear just as quickly with the next wave of discomfort or unhappiness or loss. Well, maybe this is a good segue into talking about unfairness and injustice. We seem to be heading in that direction. I mentioned last night what a difficult time I had trying to find references in psychology and psychiatry in this whole area. On fate, and that only really in Jung did I find any mention of fate. Well, it was even harder to find anything on fairness. Although again, in Jung, he does address issues related to injustice and unfairness. But I really think that what I fell back on was my own experiences and the experiences of people I was working with around this whole issue of fairness. What is fair? And we often hear that sort of retort, well, whatever made you think life was supposed to be fair? And yet from, really from the time we can talk, that way of saying, no fair. I mean, you hear little kids do this. You know, she got the bigger piece, no fair. It's so ingrained in our souls that life should be fair. There should be equality. There should be this possibility that we all get what's good. We know that it's common in sports, and we have rules there that define what's fair and what's not fair. And there we have some guidelines, some containment about maintaining fairness. And then, of course, since people don't always like what's fair, there are fights on the field, because what's fair means that sometimes someone's going to lose and someone else is going to win, and those who lose don't like that either. So that, and I think we all know from the talking about fate and this whole issue of the wisdom movement that a sense of fairness is generally linked with ideas about being rewarded for being good. That if it's a fair world, then I'll be rewarded for my goodness. And if it's fair, then the guys who do bad things will be punished. And so we've already, dealt a good bit with that. These sort of golden rules, if you do unto others as you would have them do unto you, then you get the goodies. And then there's the related concept to fairness and unfairness, which is that of justice and injustice. And that one's a little easier to find information on, because justice, again, goes back to Greek mythology. And in Greek mythology, the goddess of justice was Themis. She was the goddess of law and order, and particularly with respect to the natural relations between the sexes. What was right and what was wrong between men and women. In addition to the Moirai, who were the daughters of Zeus and Themis, there were also the Horai, who were Eunomia, whose name means lawful order, and Dike, whose name means justice, or just retribution, and Irene, whose name meant peace. Now, Dike was considered to be the personification of justice, and it's told in the Greek myths that she eventually fled to the mountains when humankind ceased to attend to her pronouncements. And legend has it that she eventually became so distressed with human behavior that she left the earth altogether, and she went to live in the sky, where she became the constellation Virgo, which tells you something about what the early Greeks, and I think it's really important. And maybe this is my effort to personalize it, but I have this image of the Greeks living life just the way we do, struggling with the same kinds of things that we struggle with, even though they didn't have cars and computers and all of that. But they were constantly trying to understand and explain. And they did that through their theology and through their tragedy and through their stories. And so that as they struggled with the injustice in the world, they could imagine that their goddess of justice having to leave the earth and having to go live up in the sky because there just wasn't adequate justice on it. It just wasn't fair. Now, another conception around justice seems to have to do with what happens after we're dead. What happens, you know, whether we get to go to heaven or we get condemned to hell. And there's this wonderful book, whose name I'm... Is that one by Moon? That archetypal imagery, that big one, remember? Came out a couple of years ago. Well, anyway, in this book, she talks about the four categories of judgment, and the first involves instances of rebirth in which one's life and death will determine the status of one's place in the next life, so that how we live and how we die will determine what happens to us. And this is you know, contained very obviously, I think, in the Indian notion of karma, that karma differs a little bit from fate in the sense that how we live, how we make our choices, will determine what happens to us when we're reborn again, or maybe we'll reach such a level that we're above having to live on this earth and can live beyond. And then the second type of judgment involves the deceased having to pass through some kind of ordeal or some kind of test, like crossing a narrow bridge. And that bridge will hold if the person has been good in their life, but it will break if the person has sinned. And so people, again, this kind of fear of the judgment influenced the way they would live because of their fear of what would happen after death. And the third type of judgment she talks about is the judgment that employs the metaphor of the scale, that, you know, that image that we have of justice that we sometimes see on the courthouse with the blind female figure holding the scales of justice. And one example of this that I thought was kind of interesting is that in ancient Egypt, the common belief was that if a person's life had been good, that after death, their heart on a scale would balance against a feather. And so that if they had a good heart, it would be a very light heart that would balance against a feather. But if they had been bad in their lives, if they had done things to die with a heavy heart, that their heart would overbalance the feather, and they would be sent down into the netherworld to suffer with devouring monsters and all kinds of terrible things. And the fourth type of judgment that she talks about has involved the metaphor of the king. And she describes the belief in China that when a person dies, they go before the god of the dead, who is Yen Lo, or Yen Lo Wang. And he's responsible for administering the punishments to the dead and deciding the fate of the deceased. And his decision was said to be a blind one and was to be completely impartial. And so that people lived in fear of what Yen Lo would do once they had to go before him in the afterlife. And I think that we all know, too, that this kind of metaphor of the king as a source of judgment is common in Christian belief. This notion of Christ as the judge in the heavenly court, and that we've kind of adopted that image into our culture, our current Western culture, as I mentioned, the scale defining justice in the courts, or that sense of our deeds being weighed and being measured and being judged as we go through life, depending on how we see that happening, whether it's at the end of our lives or whether it's when we go to confession or whenever that happens. So I thought that these were that these were kind of interesting ways in which justice has kind of, has been defined and metaphorically described through different cultures and through different ages. And I'm kind of wondering what you all are thinking about the sense of justice and fairness and those kinds of things. There is that sense that fair means having our own way. and that having our own way could be all kinds of things. I think of it as the way it is with children. Fair means having what they want right now. And it takes growing up some for that sense of guilt to evolve around whether it's okay to have what we want, whether having what we want is going to end up causing us to be punished. One of the people sitting over in this area last night was saying that that one of the things that that she comes to feel when things are going well is kind of that sense of kind of waiting for the other shoe to drop, which would mean that there's going to be a reversal. When things start going too well, it's not going to stay that way for long. There's going to be deprivation or pain or loss or something, which is unfair. But there's almost a feeling that what's fair, what's good, what I want for myself isn't okay. It's not something that can be permitted for very long. So I think there may be, I wonder if there may be this sense at some point as the child matures and grows up in this kind of causal thinking mode of beginning to feel that way, beginning to feel that it's not okay to for things to go too well or for things to go well at all. And fair is relative, as you point out. It depends on which end of the rope you're on, you know, in a tug of war. Mm-hmm. That's right. Yeah. And when they were still slaves in Egypt, it was not fair to the Israelites to be building the pyramids while the Egyptians held the whip. And so it depends on your perspective, on where you stand with respect to the event, whether it's fair or unfair. What's being given out, what's being dished out. And we could ask, you know, when you say lopsided in our sense of fair play, we could ask where has fairness gone in this effort to always come out the winner or the one who gains?
And that is the end of the tape. Copyright C.G. Jung Society, Seattle, and the speaker. All rights reserved. No copying, please.